Good evening and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn and our theme tonight is sin. So, welcome to the biggest confessional you will ever encounter. Or perhaps if you're from a different persuasion, an accountability session. Welcome to the 10 by 9 podcast, and what a wonderfully sinful night we had on Wednesday, May 14th at the Black Box in Belfast. The stories were amazing, as you might expect, and there are 3 of them on this podcast, 2 from first-timers.
We would go to the church beside the school. I was ambivalent about this. The outside terrified me because there was a carving of Oliver Plunkett's head over the door.
Thanks to my grandparents, one of the things I cannot fail to remember is love. Love for family, love for community, love for strangers.
By this stage, I had stopped normal everyday screaming and was was screeching prayers at the top of my voice. If he would only get us off Big Thunder Mountain alive.
So prepare for confessions of a country schoolgirl, the misplaced guilt of a sickly teenager, and an appeal for mercy. But is it murder or manslaughter? Now, as someone who was once described as a product of sin, a story that's featured somewhere on our 300 podcasts, I was so looking forward to this event, and I was not disappointed. But enough about me, let's get started. And it was her first time at the 10 by 9 mic, though you wouldn't know it. Here's Fiona O'Neill.
So, in these enlightened times, when children first receive the sacrament of reconciliation, they are taught to talk about a time when they didn't show love. For my own daughter's turn, we were invited to the school hall to watch and blink back tears as our little ones took turns to go to the front and come back smiling for a hug. Then there was tea and biscuits. There was none of that when I was 6. In those days, it was first confession, and we were dealing with the business of sin, not love. In my bright, modern for the time P3 classroom, beside where the band joined Loch Ness, our teacher put us over the procedure. We would go to the church beside the school. I was ambivalent about this. The outside terrified me because there was a carving of Oliver Plunkett's head over the door. But it was lovely inside with floor-to-ceiling windows. It was modern, unlike my church at home. We were to go into one side of the confession box and talk quietly but not whisper. It wasn't easy to get the pitch right. Our teacher told us that older people sometimes forget and talk too loud, then everyone waiting outside would clear their throats and shuffle their feet so they couldn't hear. Then they would look down and pray hard when the person came out so they didn't have to look at them. It could be quite funny to see them all stamping and coughing, but it would be a terrible thing to hear a sin. She was responsible for teaching us about sin, when we had done something wrong and wanted to be forgiven. She asked us to think of examples and she would put them on the blackboard. I had many examples. When I was in P1, I had peed myself during my first Irish dancing class while I was trying to learn the in front and behinds. The dancing teacher had said nobody else was to ask to go to the toilet, and I took him at his word. The big girl who lived across the road from me took me by the hand. She smiled as though I hadn't done something so terrible that the master and all the children stared at me in mortal silence, broken only by the squelch of my black gutties as I walked the full length of the hall. It was a blessing I had no dancing pumps yet, for they would have been ruined. She told me it was all right not to worry. So did my mother. She said it wasn't my fault, it was only an accident, and next time I should just ask to go to the toilet. But the master had been very clear on not asking. I knew I had done wrong, no matter what that kind big girl or my mammy said. I didn't go back to the dancing for about 4 years, and I don't think he recognized me. When I was in P2, the teacher left the classroom for a few minutes, and all the children started messing. There was so much noise, I was sure nobody would hear me if I screamed over it. I wanted to see what that would be like, so I put my hands over my ears, shut my eyes, and squealed one long high note. I drew breath and opened my eyes to silence and the return teacher glaring over her thick framed glasses. She didn't say anything, but I knew from previous experience of silence. There were many others. I didn't share my smoky bacon crisps. We were supposed to hand them round to everyone, but sometimes there were too many people and there would have been none for me. I left Lady Bird books all over the floor and didn't put away my jigsaws. I told tales on my brother. I put my shoes on without undoing the buckles and bent the back of them. I took my shoes off in my granny's house when I wasn't supposed to. All the cousins did that as a form of protest. Some of my cousins used to say bad words when we would play out the back of my granny's. There was a communal yard leading onto gardens that all ran into each other. We would race along between them. Once the cousins ran away from me and I was scurried down at the neighbour's garden trying to catch up. Exhausted and furious, I stopped, stood still and said one of those words. The one you're probably thinking of. Just to myself. I had never said it or anything like it aloud before. I ran on and nearly bumped into the woman who owned the garden. She didn't say anything, though she smiled and nodded under her white pin curls. Another silence, yet this one was gentle, so I thought I had got away with it. All good sins, but I knew the most shocking one of all. My mother told me not to do this every day of life. I put up my hand. I was always doing that because I was a good scholar. Brushing your teeth after putting your jumper on. Excuse me. The teacher laughed a little and explained graciously, oh no, that's not a sin. It's an accident. This didn't make sense. What was the difference? I didn't have to ask, she explained. If you were to think to yourself, I want to make work for my mummy and I'm going to take my jumper and put toothpaste all over it, that would be a sin. As if anybody would do that. But if you just got some toothpaste on it when you were brushing your teeth, that would be an accident. My teacher didn't understand this concept. My mummy was quite clear on brushing teeth and jumpers. Then this boy, one of the Murrays, who we called Murray Mint, too good to hurry Mint, put his hand up with a tentative smile, pulling the coat hook through your jumper. I thought well of him and wanted the teacher to write that one down. This time she didn't smile. Now that's just an accident. I already said not to tell me about accidents. Somebody tell me a sin that's not an accident. That scene is imprinted in my memory. I see the page boy haircuts for both boys and girls, over bright eyes, chins tilted up and mouths open in incomprehension, all sitting in the sunny classroom that smelled of old milk, pencil sharpenings and grey rubbers. Then, being a good scholar, I understood. It was revealed to me, like Paul on the way to Damascus. The gravest sin is to say something is a sin when it's only an accident. Especially if your teacher told you not to. I resolved to confess and then I would be free of it. My memory stops there. The children are still sitting in their toothpaste and hole-free jumpers. The teacher still has a chalk in her hand trying to write down sins. I don't remember what happened next. I hope somebody said adultery and we moved on to spellings. Now that I'm grown up and have committed many sins, had lots of accidents, held grudges, forgiven and been forgiven, it's clear to me that the new way is better. Tell children to talk about love. Then they really won't know what's going on.
What a way to make your debut, Fiona. Wonderful story, wonderfully told, and the audience loved you. Thanks so much. Come back with more soon. Like Fiona, if you want to tell your story, the process is simple. Check out the themes on the website, then send your story through the submissions page. I'll give you feedback and help you make it the best it can be. If you're nervous, please don't worry. You are never alone. It's a collaborative process from start to finish. Okay, on to our second story, and it too comes from a first-timer. Here's Phil Simon.
On the 5th of March, 2009, I became a murderer. When I was age 6 or 7, my mother was doing her best to listen to Mrs. Chatta, my primary 2 teacher, and her incoherent ramblings about my abysmal behaviour, my distractibility, and the lack of this magical quality everyone else in the class seemed to have in abundance, focus. Growing up, I had 2 sets of grandparents, Granny and Granda with a tractor, and Granny and Granda without the tractor. Granny and Granda with a tractor were old school, they were farmers, traditional as they come, for God and Ulster. Admittedly, we don't see eye to eye on everything, neither God nor Ulster. But they were happy to fill me with sugar and fizzy drinks, much to my mum's dismay. Their house quickly became my place of sanctuary. They'd send me off with an axe to split logs, a brush to clear up after chickens, or tell me tales of cowboys and wild horses, and watch as I sprinted off after a herd of calves with as much chance of catching them as Mrs. Chatta getting me to sit still for 5 minutes. One summer, at a farm fair, my granny with a tractor ignored the height restrictions on a quad bike ride. Now, I don't know whether it was common sense, the much too enthusiastic way I pleaded, or a recent bit of Mrs. Chatta's ramblings about my behaviour bouncing about the inside of my mum's head. But when I asked for what I was hoping for months, it was easily rebuked with a simple no. However, since getting told by mum no, something beautiful, wonderful, magical even had happened since this answer. My mum had left. She was no longer by the quads, but my granny was. On I got. Hardly able to reach the handles, hardly able to reach the footholds. Off I go. Nothing would stop me. Spinning the accelerator handle downwards, jolting forwards, wind through my bowl cut. Nothing could stop me now. The blur of people whizzing past as I struggled to maintain the little control I had. At some point, someone realised that although I was still within the confines of the course, this small child was well out of their depth. The tiny amount of control I had rapidly diminishing. So the operator makes the call. My time on the quad bike was up. My thrill-seeking dream ride, it was over. There's a famous paradox about what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object. Well, in this moment, the paradox was put to the test. Standing with his legs and arms widespread, signaling me to come to a halt was the operator, the unmovable object. Wind through my bowl cut, just about managing to hold on, an unstoppable force. Nothing could stop me now. The good news, with a scream and a bump, the question of the paradox had been solved. The bad news, the out-of-control child in the quad, had not. Wind through my bowl cut, pedal to the metal, holding on now for dear life. Nothing could stop me. The operator lay there, I assume in disbelief, and safe to assume, a significant amount of pain. 2001 guidance for traumatic injury was to stay still and not move in case of causing further injury. He was doing an exemplary job of this. Until he heard the words, "He's coming round again." The out-of-control quad was quick, but the adrenaline must have been quicker as he managed to escape a second collision. But the next lap round, a large team of adults and onlookers managed to tackle me off, release the accelerator, and drag a relieved, but slightly unfazed, young me off the quad. I do hope the man hadn't been haunted or too injured by my actions. Lots of lessons were learnt. I learnt how to use a quad's accelerator. My granny learnt that under no further circumstances would I go on quads in future. And the quad company learnt how to install remote kill switches on all their quad bikes. Fast forward many years to 16-year-old me. I had a brain infection, encephalitis. On top of other complications, this resulted in me being unable to remember huge swathes of memories. I saw photos of myself and genuinely believed somebody had photoshopped me into them. I was unable to remember much of my childhood. People talk and reminisce. I felt like a guest at the dinner table, trying to complete a dot-to-dot of memories, only able to use less than a quarter of them. Thanks to my grandparents, one of the things I cannot fail to remember is love. Love for family, love for community, love for strangers. I don't think my granny has ever failed to offer anyone who approaches her door a cuppa, with a sit, which quickly becomes a sit-down dinner. The offer of a drink and friendly conversation through gentle, classic, old-school hospitality in which connections are made, stories are remembered and retold, and friendships forged. Through talking to my granny, she's reminded me of the many hours I spent with my granda, fascinated as he painted country landscapes, watching and listening as he told stories and memories of places through the strokes of a brush, helping him test and write up his blood sugars all at the kitchen counter, and being a rather unhelpful hand around the farm. But so I have to return. Most murders fall into one of four categories: lust, love, loathing, or loot. I became a murderer and a looter in one simple action, greedily helping myself to a bottle of Lucozade from the second shelf to fuel my afternoon of chasing cows, splitting logs, and throwing myself out of a treehouse to see how far I could fly. On the 5th of March 2009, my granda slipped into a dip. His blood sugar levels dropped lower, lower, and lower. He never returned. He died. Meanwhile, I was slept soundly, blissfully unaware of what was happening, exhausted from a rather hard day's play. Although I didn't witness him die, I pictured his death multiple times. Paramedics performing CPR, willing him back to life, his dry lips gasping for sugar, my granny tearing through the cupboards looking for a missing bottle of Lucozade from the second shelf. The empty space on the second shelf consumed me with guilt, and it played out in my granda's death tape on repeat for years and years, from all the angles, again and again. In reality, though, talking and remembering with my granny many years later, I now know this wasn't quite accurate. He passed peacefully in his sleep, and there was nothing more that could have been done. Recently, I told her my story, my version of events, and she corrected them, replacing some of the bootleg version I'd been replaying in my head. His blood's dipped, he passed into a diabetic coma, and he did die. But he passed peacefully in his sleep. There were at least four spare bottles on the second shelf. They wouldn't have done anything. There was nothing more that could have been done. So I still piece together dots and memories. I love learning more about the old stories of my family. It brings a regained sense of familiarity with my granda. And through these conversations, I'm learning to forgive myself for a self-imposed murder charge. There will be things that we will never have seen eye to eye on, neither God nor Ulster. However, one thing I hold dear is the way you remember, celebrating the little things. So here's to you. Granny and Granda with a tractor.
In case you're wondering what that noise was at the end of the story, Phil brought a bottle of Lucozade to toast his grandparents. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Phil. I think you can hear how much the audience enjoyed that. I hope we'll see you again soon. It turned out I used to work with Phil's parents, Michael and Miriam, for many years, and it was lovely to see them at the Black Box to hear Phil's story. Just a quick thank you very much to all of you who donate or have donated to 10x9, whether it's via Patreon or at our live events over the years. It really helps keep this project going, and we are so grateful. If you're interested in donating, just go to Patreon or make a one-off donation via PayPal using our email address. And just before I move on, I just want to say a big hello to 10x9 Galveston. They've been going for a few months now, and Dave Warner, who was the driving force, has been keeping me informed as to how they're getting on, and they seem to be getting on just fine. Looking forward to a visit to the island before too long. Okay, on to our third and final story on this sin-filled podcast. And what a night we had in the Black Box. So many confessions, nothing illegal, honest. But we finished the evening with this story. She's a 10x9, semi-regular, but a total joy. Here's Pat Scott.
Is killing your mother-in-law a sin? The sixth commandment states, thou shalt not kill. But I'm undecided as to whether or not this refers explicitly to murder that's premeditated and with the intention to cause grievous bodily harm, or a bit of manslaughter. Unlawful, yes, but without intent. But before I get into moral gymnastics, I need to tell you how all these musings came about. I was pregnant with only a few weeks to go until my due date when gestational dementia kicked in, aka baby brain. and I decided that the spare bedroom needed to be redecorated for the new baby. My mother-in-law took pity on me and kindly offered to help me with my absurd plan. We got into a good rhythm of working. I would measure, cut, and paste the wallpaper, and she would go up the stepladder and stick it on the wall. About halfway through the task, my mother-in-law said that she had a strange sort of pain in her chest. I got her down off the ladder and ran through all the usual questions. How long had she had the pain? It had just started. Did it radiate down her arm or into her back or jaw? No. On a scale of 1 to 10, how severe was it? 3. Was she breathless? No. Had she ever felt a similar pain before? Yes. When I heard that, I doubled down on the questions around when she had felt it before. It turned out she had had a hiatus hernia, which played up like that every now and again. I asked what she normally did for that pain, and she told me she took an antacid. This was great news, as being pregnant, I had bottles of Gaviscon all over the house. After giving her a few swigs of one, I handed her another sheet of wallpaper and got her back up the ladder. To my everlasting shame, I was so absorbed with the notion of getting the room finished that I never revisited her chest pain. Apparently later that evening, when the pain, rather than subsiding, had got worse, she went up to the ED. I'm sure you know where this is going. She was diagnosed as having had a heart attack and would later be stented to sort out the blockage. I felt terrible. Apart from the fact that I would have had to live with the guilt of killing her if she had died, how would I have explained to my sisters-in-law that despite being an experienced nurse, I had misdiagnosed their mum as having a jippy tummy? I tried to justify it to myself as a sin of omission, if indeed it was actually a sin at all. But from that time on, my mother-in-law never had another heart attack, although she did sometimes have angina attacks. But overall, I felt like I'd dodged a bullet. About 10 years later, we decided to have a family holiday in Disneyland, Florida. Both my mother-in-law and father-in-law were coming with us for a trip to remember. Now, I hate roller coasters, so I wasn't that keen to go on the thrilling rides. I was frequently joined on the tamer ones by my eldest son, who, like me in those days, preferred to not have the Nelly skirt out of him. One afternoon, our party of eight stood looking at the Big Thunder Mountain ride. It was hard to really see what it entailed because after the first bend, it disappeared out of sight and we couldn't see it again until it trundled back in and stopped at the exit gate. I didn't like the fact that I couldn't tell how scary it was, but was coming under pressure to not be a spoil sport and for the whole family to go on the ride together. It would be such good crack and something not only I could experience, but Granny and Granda as well. I moved over a little bit to watch the previous ride coming back in. They were nearly all laughing loudly, shouting and hugging each other, with just a few quieter looking ones walking off, trance-like, and dazed without any real expression on their faces. I studied the billboard picture. Everyone looked happy with their arms in the air as if they were having the time of their lives. No one had white knuckles from gripping onto the safety bar, nor did they appear to be thrown up over the side of the car. It was decision time. I was certainly not convinced, but I said that if Granny and Granda would do it, then so would I. They weren't keen either, but because I wouldn't go on without them, they capitulated. This bit of negotiation would very quickly come back to bite me. We joined the queue and were swept along to where we had to board the cars. My father-in-law and mother-in-law got into one car together. My husband and the keenest of the boys climbed into another. The girls went together in a third car. So that just left myself and our other son, the two scaredy cats, together. To add insult to injury, the only car left was the front one. We sat nervously as a young fella, a child really, came round and lowered the safety bar into position. I gave it a shake, but that was not reassuring. as there seemed to be loads of movement in it, which was leaving a pretty big gap between us and the bar. I tried to express my concerns without sounding like a basket case before we'd even left. But he poo-pooed my fears and rang a bell that told us that we were there until they either let us off or we fell out. As the cars lurched forward, my son and I clutched hands, leaving my right hand out of commission. But as I also had a big handbag to hold on to, it meant that I then had no hand spare to hold on to the safety bar. As we rounded the first corner, I could see a steep hill ahead of us. It was fine being the front car on the way up the hill. But as we stopped momentarily on the crest, we had a panoramic view of what we were about to be catapulted down. Both of us started screaming at the top of our lungs. With no thoughts of maintaining any dignity or decorum, my son then gripped my arm with his remaining hand, meaning that neither of us were holding on to anything static. The result of this was that as we hurtled round corners, we were sliding out of control across the seat, crashing into the side just in time for the next corner when we crashed back to the other side. By this stage, I had stopped normal everyday screaming and was... was screeching prayers at the top of my voice and making all sorts of promises to God if he would only get us off Big Thunder Mountain alive. Each fast propulsion up a hill made me feel like my stomach was being dropped into my boots, only to then be forced back up into my throat on the even faster drop down the subsequent slope. The up and down movement had combined with us being thrown from side to side, and I started to feel sick. But throwing up whilst being thrown about could not end well. I had a picture of me hurling vomit in front of me, only for it to come straight back. With the force of the wind and stick to my face and hair. There was nothing else for it. I was going to have to book into my handbag. But try as I might, I could not open it one-handed. Thankfully, just as the vomit was starting to come up, we began to slow down in preparation for disembarking. I wept with relief. My prayers had been answered. We clambered off with our legs shaking. I caught a glimpse of my face in the window. It was a mixture of chalk white from fear with a greenish tinge from the nausea. As I sat down to try and compose myself, I could see my mother-in-law staggering unsteadily towards me. In contrast to me, her face was a purplish-grey colour, with the perspiration sitting in beads on her forehead and top lip, and a blue ring round her mouth. "I've terrible pain," she gasped, as she gripped her fists against the centre of her chest. "I can't breathe properly. I think I'm having a heart attack." Surely this couldn't be happening again. As I quickly helped her onto the seat, all thoughts of Big Thunder Mountain disappeared and were replaced with the chilling fear of what I was going to say to my two sisters-in-law about how I had successfully killed their mother on the second attempt. I rummaged through a handbag and got the GTN spray. I don't remember how many squirts of it that I gave to her, but gradually her pain began to settle and her breathing got steadier. She looked ghastly. We explained the situation to the stewards and were allowed to bring the car close to where she was sitting. By now, she felt like her head was exploding from all the spray. So we got her back to the villa and off to bed. I spent the evening checking in on her and thinking of how this could have ended very differently. It was a much more sober-looking party that returned to Disneyland the next day, whilst Granny continued to recuperate. So, back to my ethical dilemma. If she had died, would it have been put down as involuntary? Gross negligence manslaughter, where there had been a significant failure on my part to take reasonable care? And would that have been a sin? Or would it have been possible that I had got away with the perfect murder?
Oh, Pat. Thank you so, so much. I bumped into Pat, a couple of friends, in a garden centre down by Lurgan a couple of weeks ago, and she said, "Oh, I've got something that might make a piece for you." And I said, "Oh, go on, send it in." And she sent it in, and I laughed as much as you did. I mean, just brilliant. Thank you so much, Pat. Fantastic.
Oh, I'm so glad I was at that garden centre. Thanks so much, Pat. I think it's obvious the audience loved that story and the way you told it. Brilliant. You sent us home with a good belly laugh. Thank you.
And that's it for this podcast of Sin. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website, 10by9.com. And when you find a theme that fits, send me your story. 10by9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, /X, Facebook, and or Instagram. And you can get in touch via email at 10by9belfast@gmail.com. Thanks to everyone who helped make 10by9 happen this month. The wonderful Margaret, Leanne, and Cara, who are always so supportive and have never sinned in their lives. Thanks to the lovely team at the Black Box, the best venue in Belfast. Thanks to the immaculate 10by9 audience, of course. They really help support the storytellers and me. And boy, do they love a confession. And of course, thanks to all the storytellers who bared their souls. But a special thanks this week goes to Fiona O'Neill, Phil Simon, and Pat Scott. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.